Well, we meet again. I'm your host, Matt Mittler, in case you forgot. And this is Sunday Night Noir. We're working our way through Kaufman's Holiday. It's still part one, Pagan Rites. And coming up right now is episode 3. Chapter 16. I didn't pal around with them, if that's what you're inferring. She was becoming irritated. Good. He'd kept the questioning light during the meal. BLT complete with frilly toothpick for him, Cobb salad for her. Then he started to shake things up a little. Unrest always aided the soliloquy. She drained the rest of her RC, slurping through a straw. Her eyes blinked a half dozen times, and she continued. They were boys. No girls allowed. They didn't include me. I was also younger, but I was still on the block. Horizon House was headquarters. I guess it began when they were in grade school. Everyone played together.
Princes and paupers?
It didn't matter what kind of place you lived in, who your parents were, how much money you had.
Long as you were white and friends with Jesus. Explains how Bradley Glenn made the team.
I think Patrick met Robert Richards first, then Jimmy Fry. Bradley fell in with them a year or so later, and Johnny Reed after that. But Patrick and Bradley were inseparable. Patrick was always the one in charge of whatever game they were playing, and Bradley would be, like, second in command. I'm sure their hijinks were innocent enough when they were little, but as they got older, things changed. Clayton would egg them on. He probably got more of a kick from the shenanigans than they did. Probably reminded him of his own disreputable youth. But it made me sick. If you weren't of the breed, of a blood brother, you didn't stand a chance. Negroes, schoolgirls,
Jews.
She folded her napkin into neat pleats. Anyone who was different. One time they ganged up on a couple down on the docks. A colored couple, Portuguese. They peed on them and threw them in the bay. Bradley fished them out with a gaff. I heard them snickering about it out back by the fountain. They were making fun of Bradley. Can you imagine that?
I'd rather not. Don't want to use up my reserve of hate. So why would Bradley stick around then?
I don't know. He really wasn't like the rest of them. He never was. But my brother, he reveled in these sorts of monstrous acts. Maybe Bradley just liked the challenge.
Maybe he also liked being around you.
Kaufman twirled a cellophane-topped toothpick between his fingertips. She looked at him with a soft smile. He was shy around me, but we'd sometimes climb cliff walk together or go to the beach. That was when we were kids, before Mother died, before the Patriots were the Patriots. We still found some time together, but when the gang was in full swing, there wasn't any place for me. Bradley made sure of that, especially when they'd been drinking. He didn't trust them around women, even his best friend's sister. He was probably right.
She looked down, buttoned her sweater.
They were pawing all over a friend of mine. She got away before it got serious. But I never brought anyone else over to visit. I blame Clayton for that more than anyone. I went out on dates. I began to have my own life.
Did you date Bradley? She bunched her porcelain brow.
Oh, no. Bradley never even asked me out. I probably would have. He was just sort of like a brother. A good brother. He was even living with us then.
This was after his father's injury. She took another sip of soda.
I guess Mrs. Glenn must have told you. It was pretty horrible. Clayton took him in. It didn't seem right, but, well, it was probably what he needed. But then Bradley was acting sort of cold to me, and then he just completely closed off. They all went back to college. Clayton was paying Bradley's tuition. But even when he came home from school, and then over the summer, he wouldn't even look at me.
And how was he when he came back, after the war? She was silent, poked a cylindrical piece of ice out of her glass and slipped it over her finger like a ring.
He kept to himself a lot. That whole week before Patrick died, we hardly ever saw him. It's just starting to get a little better now. You have to understand, he's been through a lot.
Chapter 17. The Patriots were a quintet, but this tune was for two. Bradley was Patrick's closest chum. He was with him in the 104th. He was with him at Dora Middlebow. He was with him the night Patrick died. And now he was living under his roof. Why was little Miss Marr pointing at Daddy and crying wolf? If this was murder, Bradley Glenn was as likely a suspect as any. If Glenn had been the only responsible one in the clan, it would explain why Walsh welcomed the plebe. Certainly an improvement over his own son. But Bradley Glenn's presence didn't seem to stop the Patriots from wreaking havoc on the home front. Kaufman wondered what influence he could have had in Germany. He also wondered if Bradley Glenn owned a silver lighter. But that question would have to wait. Mara dropped him off on Broadway. They made arrangements to meet later at the office where she worked. Some kind of advocacy program. Typical summer do-goody type job. She'd fleshed out a clearer picture for him, but this was only the gospel according to St. Mara. Until he could corroborate it, it wasn't worth a nickel. Meantime, Kaufman figured he'd stop by the post office, find out what a blind man sees. Walking up the white steps, he started to feel conspicuous. It wasn't that he was perilously close to the police station. It was the man in the uniform standing inside the open doors. Tall and broad-shouldered, Peter Glenn was a monument to righteousness. Kaufman slowed down and prepared to pass him by, but the guard's torso turned ever so slightly.
"Good morning, sir. New in town?"
Stopped him dead in his tracks.
"Nah, I'm an old-timer. Just back for a visit."
Kaufman investigated the face. Skin shiny and pink, rippled like a running stream. No hair on this alien terrain. The eyes were cloudy, gray. Flesh gobbed up over one. The other bore straight through him, past him, into some distant void. The guard responded.
"Not so old, I imagine. Been out on the cliffs." "I'm sorry, what?"
Kaufman leaned in.
"You've got some stones stuck in the bottom of your shoe. A hardy climb would do that."
Kaufman was starting to forget who was the detective here. He lifted up his heel and pried out a pebble.
"You're good."
The guard held out his hand.
"Pete Glenn."
Kaufman gave it a firm shake.
"Mo Kaufman. Pleased to meet you."
Peter Glenn pulled back. His hand shot up to his mouth,
traveled past a mutilated ear and grabbed the back of his sinewy neck. "You're from Newport?"
His voice grew thin.
Yeah. Forget Bradley Glenn and the Patriots.
Kaufman looked for an exit.
Was your family...
Peter Glenn's face twisted up.
Did your family own Kaufman Jewelers?
A horse kicked to the sternum. Why hadn't he used the alias?
No.
Kaufman squeezed out the words.
No, my father's in textiles. In Fall River. My mother, she makes doilies.
Peter Glenn's vacant eyes seemed to scan Kaufman. The color drained from his marbled face, and his lashless lids began to flutter.
Well, welcome back to Newport, Mr. Kaufman.
Chapter 18. Thickening clouds had overtaken the sky, and a light rain was beginning to drizzle down. The temperature had dropped 20 degrees. Or maybe it was just him. Bradley Glenn. Peter Glenn. How much did Maura know? Surely she knew about this. On the corner of Burnside and Broadway, he stood before a boarded-up building. The gilded sign was charred but still legible. Kaufman Jewelers. He gnawed his lower lip. The place was untouched. Not as a memorial to two old Semites, just that no one had gotten around to it yet. He knew a fireman had been trapped inside when the roof collapsed. Never bothered to get his name. Heard he survived, that's all. If you call sightless and deformed survival. Maybe it was, considering the sentry's holy countenance. But Mr. and Mrs. Kaufman hadn't been so fortunate. Joseph and Hannah, Mom and Dad. They were found in the back room, clutched in each other's arms. Cremation isn't kosher, but they didn't have much of a choice. He and Eli had identified the bodies. Who else could they be? Cops had come up with some cockamamie story about a soldering iron falling to the floor, but Kaufman's weren't careless. In some ways, this was his first legit case. Or at least the first time something real was at stake. Not that he needed extra motivation. This was the scene of a crime. A fire like that either started small, in which case there'd be plenty of time to escape, or it started big, in which case it was arson. He'd snooped around the scene for days, torn it apart top to bottom. Cops were amused at first, but that didn't last long. If there'd been any wrongdoings at Kaufman Jewelers, no one wanted to know about it. And not just the police. The synagogue made him a pariah. Leave it alone, Moisha. You'll bring tsoros on the whole congregation. And then his brother went and sided with the mob. In the end, Kaufman bailed. He got nothing but a knot in his gut. Well, that and a silver cigarette lighter. Engraved with a motto. If the maxim had been Hebrew, no problem. Yiddish, even better. But it was in Latin. Sanguinis vinculum. Kaufman never told anybody about the lighter. He'd held on to it, along with the slim promise that someday he'd have an answer. Maybe that day was drawing nearer. Fry had a lighter like that. Maybe every patriot had one. No wonder Maura hired him. He didn't know whether to thank her or curse her. Again, he looked up at the sign, squinted. With the scorched letters, you could almost read it as Kaufmanners. Missing man and Jew. Enough. What, he should sit Shiva for 3 years? He spit off the curb. Took Farewell Street up to Elm and cut over to Third,
past 5 bars on the way, made him grind his teeth. Did Mara know about the accident, too? He'd met Therese at the start of that bleary-eyed holiday, and before the haze had lifted, he'd watched her die, left the car and body burning out by the Castle Hill lighthouse. More flames. Just what he needed. More flames. And then her family turned on him, her crazy possessive kid brother, just like his own crummy brother, Eli. Both wanted his head. Funny how no matter how disgusted with yourself you get, you're not too disgusted to stop drinking. He looked around. He was far from the mansions of Ochre Point, far from the snooty shops along Bellevue. Shantytown. No one entered this arena without good reason. No one, unless they were born here. A parade of poor trampled along the walkways. Folks who probably couldn't even get a job at the torpedo factory. What would happen to them once the troops returned? He noticed the Delahaye. How could you miss it? A municipal transgression. A clot of ratty ragamuffins circled the car. They scattered as Kaufman approached. The storefront was a makeshift hub for some sort of colored people's organization. A typical campaign office, except for the complexions of most of the volunteers. Lithe young women deftly collated stacks of paper on long tables. A collegiate type manned a phone at the back wall. Kaufman hung by the door. No one paid him any attention. Mara was bustling about. She carried a clipboard and was checking in at various stations. She finally caught his eye and bounded over. "Hiya, Mo." She was more energetic here. Almost a different person. Or was the other face an act? "Hey, kid, what's the score?"
"It's an ad hoc committee, started by some members of the Providence NAACP. We've got some momentum going since the Navy started desegregating. Tove Gerson dropped in yesterday. She's bringing by some of her people next week."
"Who's that?"
"She's the one who organized all those food and clothing packages for Holland. You don't read the paper?"
Mara let her jaw hang slack and made a clicking sound with her tongue.
"Anyhow, we need to be proactive. Negroes may have the vote, but they're still facing the worst kinds of discrimination."
"Sounds like some other people I know. But we've got the ADL.
"Speaking of the ADL, one of their members is working here. New fellow."
Kaufman raised an eyebrow. Mara scanned the room. There was a skinny chap off in the corner, hunched at an Underwood. She took Kaufman by the hand and led him over.
"Moses Kaufman, I'd like you to meet Myron Lipschitz."
Emmanuel Goldstein looked up. He didn't even blink. Chapter 19. Kaufman kept his lid sealed, never letting on about Goldstein. He also managed to get an additional 100 out of the girl and sidestep another joyride. He waved goodbye as the car roared off for her royal refuge. Goldstein stepped out and stood by his side.
"Nice toy!"
He made a pantomime of shifting into gear, complete with booming sound effects. Kaufman shook his head, watched Moore vanish up Elm Street.
"She can handle it," he said.
"Was the Moz?"
"That's so. Must have set Clayton back a penny."
"You're way off on that one, mezuzah man. Pop Walsh made his fortune bootlegging. But that wasn't enough to list him in the social registry."
"The mother?"
"All hers. Cars, servants, Horizon House. Now it's Clayton's."
"Interesting. That why she wants to take him down?"
"You're the detective."
"And you're the numbskull." Kaufman gave Goldstein a slap across the back of his head.
"Hey, what'd you expect? Besides, I'm on the inside now, Mo. I could write a book with what I got, and she don't even know my name."
"Lipschitz."
Had to have that Hebe ring.
The shits rings true enough. You got it stuffed between your ears.
Want the report?
Tell me over dinner.
You buyin'?
Such a Jew. They found a cheap chink joint on Farewell. Goldstein was talking with a mouthful of lo mein.
She's got an agenda for sure. Hates Walsh. Wishes he wasn't the father, and Patrick wasn't the brother. Bad blood.
He winked.
You should be able to relate to that, Mo.
Not wanting to be where you're from?
Precisely.
Don't have a clue what you're talking about, Goldie. Go on.
So, after the mother dies, there's no one keeping Clayton in check. Except for the scratch Mrs. Walsh left the kids, the rest is for Clayton to do with as he damn pleases. Girl's got no one on her team. Except maybe the Glen laddie.
Bradley Glen? Kaufman finessed his chopsticks on a platter of pork fried rice.
Yep. Comes around here now and then.
Brings her chocolates?
Nah. Don't seem romantical. More like a big brother or something.
Or something is right. He's living large at Horizon House.
That's choice. Guess he got one up on me.
And he knows about the investigation.
Who spilled them beans?
Yours truly. Hasn't swung back on Mara yet. Could soon enough. Hattery and Trask already had some fun. And some creep in a trench coat's picked up my scent.
Maybe you're the one who should get out of town.
What if I could? Meanwhile, paid a visit to the jewelry shop.
Figured you would.
Am I that easy to read?
I can pick up clues to you now.
Kaufman grabbed up a fortune cookie, broke it apart, read the fortune. He grunted and tossed it away. That fireman who burnt himself up? He's Peter Glenn, Bradley Glenn's father.
Jeez, Mo. Is this some sort of setup?
We'll see. Might lead me to the arsonist. She's got to know it'll rev me up.
Guess so, like a speeding Delahay.
Exactly. Doesn't change the Walsh case, though. Pick up anything about Patrick's war story? Goldstein ate Kaufman's cookie, picked up one for himself, put it in his pocket.
Just so happened some dame came in yesterday. Old abroad. Eleanor Roosevelt without the teeth. She was all weepy about the boy, held a hanky in a lace glove, called him a hero, said he was a beacon of light shining upon our fair city, blah, 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 blah. And she's going on like she's running for mayor. Now, Mara's this nice kid, right? Well, she just stands there in her little saddle shoes, staring at this lady with her eyes bugging out. She's got this folder in her hands, and the pages start falling on the floor. And then she flips. She's screaming that Patrick's no hero, that he doesn't even deserve to be buried at Arlington. And everyone's just ducking for cover. And this lady, she almost falls off of her heels. She's full throttle, in reverse, and waving the hanky like, Satan, be gone! And bang, Eleanor's out the door. Mara's mouth is open, but nothing more is coming out.
And she told me she didn't know what happened at the camp.
She knows her brother. Maybe she just needs the particulars.
What am I supposed to do? Get the army to open their files for me?
Must be an inn. Any Jews in Patrick's regiment?
A smile hinted on Kaufman's face. And that's why I keep you around, Goldie. Goldstein opened his toothpick container, offered one to Kaufman.
Stick with me, kiddo. We might even find the lost tribe.
Kaufman signaled the waiter for the bill, pulled a wad out from his sock and peeled off a couple of singles, added the century he caught from Mara and stuffed it all back in place. We keep apart, Lipschitz, but I'll be in touch. Where you staying?
Got a place over at the Y. They had me down as Henry Miller. Thank you.
Chapter 20.
Oh, Mr. Kaufman.
It was the annoying clerk from the previous night.
Checkout time will be 10 a.m.
I'm running a tab, remember?
We are booked solid beginning tomorrow. It's a holiday.
What holiday?
May 30th, Mr. Kaufman. Memorial Day.
He produced a $100 bill.
I was asked to return this to you. Your account's been settled, courtesy of Mr. Walsh.
Swell. Kaufman palmed the cabbage. I'd give you a tip, but it's against my religion. At least he'd have one more night in clean sheets. As the doors closed to the elevator, Kaufman took off his hat and blew the clerk a kiss. Room 313. He pulled out his key and slipped it into the lock. The door eased open without turning the knob. Not a good sign. Then a meaty fist hit him in the gut. An even worse sign. Two hands grabbed him by the lapels and flung him across the room. The door slammed closed. Lights snapped on. Hattery and Trask, at your service. Chapter 21. Fortunately, the suit was left intact, and the only thing bloodstained was the carpet, which Kaufman was now examining at close range. He got off easy. The 100 clams wouldn't be missed. He peeled himself off the floor. Room service could clean up the stain. For them, he'd leave a tip. He staggered into the bathroom, faced the mirror. Nose was off its joint. He pinched it between his thumb and forefinger, snapped it back in place, wiped a smear of blood off his upper lip, and sat down on the toilet. Ice would ease the pain. Ice in a tumbler would ease it more. He grabbed a wash rag and headed out of the room, stopped by the ice machine to load up, held the pack to his face as he exited the hotel. It was 9:20. Most spots would be closing soon. He turned up his collar to the ocean breeze and headed down to Thames Street. The sky was veiled with a sticky mist. Eclipsed the stars, but put a halo round the moon. He kept a quick clip. If he were looked upon with favor, some joint would surely open its golden gates. Before he knew it, he was back on the west side. A club with live music, proclaimed in flashing neon, was all the invitation he needed. He tossed the wash rag into a trash can, thanked the moon, and sailed inside. Smoke hovered in silky strips under a low ceiling. A moist crowd and cool jazz. An introverted combo played while a colored gal crooned, front and center. In fact, they were all colored, not just the band. Kaufman began to feel comfortably conspicuous. He snagged a stool by the bar, gave a nod to the bartender. The guy pursed his lips.
"Get you something?"
"Seltzer, with lime. Thanks." He scooped up a handful of nuts. Cozy. The vocalist was covering Billie Holiday, but she'd swapped languor for defiance. Kaufman liked that. He also liked her looks. Hershey brown and curvy. Eyes half shut like sleepy sex. Lips glossed and full. She let her hair fall into her face while she sang, then swept it back with a taunting sneer. Kaufman bobbed his knee to the beat, shut his eyes, playing along with the solos. The band wound up their set, and the audience clapped and stomped and shouted praise. Kaufman settled for a more modest response. He breathed in the heavy aroma of sweat and smoke, turned back to the bar, and ordered another seltzer.
"What's a white guy like you doing in a place like this?"
The voice poured over him like molasses. She was leaning with the curve of her back pressed against the counter.
Who you callin' white?
He removed his hat and brushed off the stool beside him. She slithered onto it and offered him her hand.
Allegra Dupree.
He took it, tapered nails and all.
Moses Kaufman, buy you a drink?
Pim's cocktail, if you please.
She held up her chin, gave her processed hair a shake. He signaled the bartender, who seemed none too happy with the mixed pairing. Kaufman flashed another bill. No problem being colorblind, long as you can see green.
Your stuff's first rate, he said.
Thanks, she replied artfully. You play?
Depends on the stakes.
Oh, we gambling now?
You tell me, Miss Dupree.
The Pims arrived, along with another seltzer. No lime, but Kaufman let it slide. She raised her glass and let it catch the light from the bar, cast a wavy wash across her almond eyes. She was gorgeous, and she knew it.
I'll tell you, and I'll raise you.
But before Kaufman could raise anything, a shadow fell over him, along with a mammoth arm cased like sausage skin in a pinstripe suit.
You have a choice. Leave now, or leave now.
The voice was a cavernous rumble. Kaufman didn't much like the mandate, but as the rest of the body loomed into view, joining the arm, which weighed like an anvil on his wrist, he decided that compliance might be in order. He followed a red silk tie to a double Windsor knot. No neck, just a thick fold of skin straining against a starched collar. On top of that, a face so bulbous it seemed about to burst. But the teeth didn't fit. Too small, like a toddler's tiny porcelains had been planted in the gargantuan features. And the eyes were all wrong, too. One burned directly into him, the other straight off to the side. Kaufman tilted toward Allegra.
You know, I really didn't feel much like playing this hand anyway.
Deuce?
Her voice was firm, but contained. Deuce set the good eye on Kaufman.
You on the clock, legs. Break's over.
Kaufman extricated his arm, stood, and slipped his hat back in place. Gave Allegra a quick wink.
I have to get packing, anyway. Night fishing off the wharf. Just keep your rod on the other side of the river,
Deuce growled into Kaufman's ear. Allegra rose. She turned her back, flipped open a shell-shaped compact, and began to reapply her lipstick. Spoke to Kaufman in a velvety hush.
I'm playing a white club Friday night. The gaslight.
He tipped his hat to both of them, slipped out from under the glare of the good eye, and made a hasty retreat. Chapter 22. Friday night. What better way to spend Shabbos than a date with a shiksa? A schwarze shiksa, no less. How'd this one get past his guard? She'd almost made him forget about Therese. He wandered over to Long Wharf. Not to fish, just to listen to the boats creaking. Besides, fishing never lasts. He'd louse it up one way or another. She'd walk off, cursing him under her breath. Better to walk off instead of getting carted away. Over on Goat Island, the lighthouse beam slowly swung his way, pointed a finger at him. You did it. You killed her, you son of a bitch. Fact was, Therese had held the wheel, but Kaufman had taken the blame, even if he hadn't taken the rap. His heap, his hooch, his holiday. The ragtop was down and he'd been thrown clear. What malicious god had spared his life?
He stepped out of the accusing ray, was ready to hang his head and shuffle off, when he caught sight of a flash over on the docks, and a silhouette. Even at a distance, Kaufman recognized the wide-brimmed hat, the long, dark coat. It's one thing being followed, but this creep seemed to precede him, pinned to his lapel like some Memorial Day poppy. Kaufman walked up Washington Street, slow enough to hear the footsteps behind him. Leather soles, no taps. About 180 pounds. Had he trailed him from Shantytown? Did he know his room number at the Viking? Kaufman angled onto Touro Street and quickened his pace. The footsteps quickened, too. Two blocks ahead, under a lone streetlight, was the old synagogue. The stone retaining wall on the side was gradated, and followed an incline of grassy turf. At the low end, Kaufman made a break. He dashed ahead, vaulted cleanly over the top, and dropped out of sight. Squatted on the other side, his back pressed into the stone wall. Waited. The steps closed in, a huff of breath. A black shadow flipped over the wall, over his head. Landed unsteady, arms outstretched. The fedora swung one way, then the other. Kaufman pressed his palms into the earth and landed a kick 8 inches above the hem of the trench coat, right about where the inside of the left knee would be. He heard a snap and a scream. The body collapsed to the ground. Kaufman stood up.
"Gonna be hard to trail with a limp."
The body writhed, gloved hands grasping the wounded knee.
"Who are you?"
Kaufman gave him a nudge with the point of his shoe. The figure quickly rolled, crouched onto all fours. The fedora shaded its face. Kaufman considered lifting the brim, but just as he reached out, the spook lunged forward, slammed Kaufman's spine into the wall, flattening his lungs. As Kaufman slid to the ground, he saw a blur of black spring over his head and fly away. Chapter 23. If this was his last night at the Viking, he wasn't about to forsake amenities. He made the bath extra hot, placed a wash rag over his face, and rested his head against the porcelain curve. Tried to drift back to the jazz club. Couldn't. That night, he had a crazy dream. He's like a gull gliding low over the breakers. He sees his hat riding on the foam and swoops down to retrieve it. But the hat rises up on its own, a soaked coat affixed below the brim. He turns to fly away, and the coat and hat follow him. But he's losing ground. It's harder to stay in the air. His arms make like he's swimming, his feet kick. Now he's running, his feet hitting the ocean surface, smacking the waves. Every step is taking him further down into the sea. He's going a mile a minute. Behind him, the coat and hat jag over the surf like a kite in a storm. In front of him, the cliffs of Easton's Beach race into view. He spins around and catches sight of a lighthouse. The beam whips over the water and smashes into him. His clothes ignite in the light and immediately turn to ash. Kaufman got out of bed, did 50 push-ups, then tried to go back to sleep. He'd finally nodded out when a brass band burst into his bedroom. He staggered over to the window and looked out at a cadre of uniformed soldiers in lockstep. Happy Memorial Day. Took a turn to the mirror. Nose would be fine, though a cute purple crescent hung below his right eye. He combed his hair, dressed, and shoved the complimentary toiletries into his jacket pockets.
He decided to forego breakfast in lieu of paying his patriotic respects. Everyone was probably out watching the procession anyway. He tossed the room key on the front desk and stepped smack into an under-rehearsed battle hymn of the Republic, courtesy of the Roger Williams High School marching band. Folks lined Bellevue, waving midget flags on tiny sticks. A troop of World War I vets passed by, army green sagging on their bones. Some looked hollow-eyed, patches of white stubble where the razor had missed its mark. Some grinned toothlessly, waving. Kaufman maneuvered through the crowd, spotted the mayor's box over by the courthouse, a couple of bleachers laden with dark-suited dignitaries. In the back row, right corner, was Casey Phelan. A squad of subordinates blocked Kaufman's path.
"Phelan!"
Kaufman hollered over a glockenspiel chorus of America the Beautiful. A surly cadet raised a palm.
"VIPs only. I think the councilman would be quite happy to have me join his party," Kaufman said loudly.
"Fat chance. Keep moving."
A cheery voice intervened.
"Mo, how you doing?"
Phelan leaned over the railing, gave Kaufman a leg up.
"I gotta tell you, Mo, I went over to the country club this morning for an early tea and tried your pivot. Best game ever. Double-eagled three holes. Should turn pro.
I just might if politics don't pay off." He gave a snort and punched Kaufman on the shoulder.
"Have a seat, pal. Hey, sorry you missed lunch yesterday. How's your ma?"
He'd almost forgotten Harlow's ruse.
"She'll be okay. They got her over at St. Joe's in Providence."
"Good hospital." He glanced over at Kaufman. "What's with the shiner?"
"Started celebrating early."
Phelan chuckled.
"Watch it. People might think you're Irish."
Kaufman scanned the rest of the booth. Didn't recognize any faces.
"Say, I wanted to share a concern of mine, Casey."
"Go ahead." Phelan was vigorously applauding a leggy majorette.
"I've been seeing some shady characters around the Viking lately."
"You don't say."
"Go a long way to post some centurions at the gates. Dusk to dawn, say?"
"Shouldn't be too hard to swing a night crew."
"Figured you'd want to act on this, Casey. You know, there's a couple of boys down at the precinct who'd do a bang-up job. Names are Hattery and Trask."
Chapter 24. At least Laurel and Hardy would be waylaid a few nights, and the trench might not be eliminated, but his pace was certainly slowed. Now Kaufman just needed to rustle up a bed and rifle some military files. He'd follow Goldstein's suggestion, see if he might track down any Jews in the 104th. Of course, to find a Jew, you need to start with a Jew. Eli lived on Catherine Street, not far from Turo Synagogue. He would have gone to the parade with the wife and kids, then returned home for lunch. God forbid they eat out. Kaufman approached the Victorian monstrosity. Once a wealthy single-family residence, the place had fallen askew and eventually been subdivided into half a dozen less than grand apartments. Eli lived in number 3 on the second floor. Kaufman stood on the sagging porch, swatted a cloud of mosquitoes, and prepared to ring the buzzer. Looked at his watch. No gifts for the kids, and Bubkiss for the wife. What the hell? There was still time for additional preparation. Over on Chapel Street was a 5 and dime where he used to read comic books off the stands. He hoped it would still be there, and it was. A gap-toothed halfwit leafed through a back issue of Boy's Life behind the counter, oblivious to the gang of snot-nosed youths debating what to spend their pennies on. Kaufman chose a balsa wood flyer for his nephew, and got the niece one of those
little dolls where you stick your fingers through the holes where the legs ought to be. He also picked out 2 giant rainbow swirled lollipops and 1 pound's worth of Mary Janes. He stuffed a 20 in the bag with the candy and slapped 2 bills on the counter. Then he grabbed an RC for the road, tossed a couple of quarters to Spanky and the gang, and braced himself for the return to Catherine Street. 2 blocks away, he moused out, grabbed a ham and Swiss at a greasy spoon, went and hung out on the boardwalk at Easton's, watched gulls spearing crabs on the shore, stayed until the Atlantic began to smell like a cocktail. Chapter 25.
Moisha, I don't believe it. Come in, we're having brisket.
Kaufman could have shown up with 6 bums off the docks, and Judith would have fed them all. She was sweet and not unpleasant to look at, though there was a certain sickly quality about her. Small bones, stringy hair, sunken rings under the eyes. Genetics. What are you going to do?
Hiya, Judy. Nice to see you again.
He gave her a peck on the cheek. Could have sworn she blushed.
Uncle Moses?
Rachel must have been about 4 last time he visited. She peeked around the kitchen door. Sammy was tight against her. He'd have been 2. Kaufman removed his hat and knelt down on 1 knee. Met them at eye level.
Uncle Moses!
Rachel led the brigade, tearing down the hall. Mouth releasing a siren wail. She leapt into his arms, while Samuel threw back a scrawny arm and smacked him on the rear.
Watch it, Buster.
Kaufman lowered Rachel to the ground and thrust his fingers into Sammy's armpits. The boy thrashed in his grasp, convulsing with laughter. Eli entered, shaking his head.
You couldn't call first?
His trumpet played a perpetual sour note. Judith widened her eyes.
Elijah, please, he's family.
He hasn't been family since 1942.
Kaufman released the boy.
And shalom to you too, Eli.
Eli took off his glasses, wiped them clean with his tie.
Shalom also means goodbye, for your elucidation.
Shalom!
Squealed Samuel. Kaufman turned his attention to the children and their mother. He pulled out the goodie bag.
Let's see what Uncle Moe's got here.
Presents!
Rachel began to hop around, swinging her arms like a windmill.
Rachel, stop jumping!
Eli snapped.
You'll annoy the neighbors.
Judith rested a hand on his shoulder.
Eli, please. She's happy to see her uncle.
Eli left the room, mumbling Yiddish under his breath. His shoulders seemed more hunched, as if he were getting a head start on old age. He was about the same height as Kaufman, but only tipped the scale at around 120. Preferred consuming himself to actual food. Left him with a rigid physique and a puritanical outlook. Fortunately, the kids didn't take after Eli. They were both jumping up and down now and tugging at Kaufman's jacket. He had to deliver or suffer the consequences. The flyer was an instant hit, looping around the living room, endangering various articles of china. Rachel's fingers stood in for the doll's legs, with tiny booties on her fingertips. She began to walk the toy over a bookcase, softly reciting a verse from Kipling.
Almost forgot.
Kaufman held the paper bag out to Judith. The suckers are for the kids. The rest is your call. She took the bag and looked down the hall to make sure Eli was out of sight. Reached in like a giddy kid herself and pulled out the 20, unwrapped a Mary Jane, and popped it in her mouth. Chapter 26.
You shamed them while they lived. What?
Now they'll be proud of you from the grave. You think you're doing a mitzvah?
Judith had sent the children off to play and was bustling about. Kaufman was too busy trimming gristle off his brisket to be annoyed with his brother.
Eli, believe me, I didn't take on this case for the approval of my people.
You have no people, Moshe, in case you hadn't noticed.
Oh, I've noticed. But blood is thicker than religion.
Eli threw down his paper.
You think Judaism is a religion? What religion was massacred in Europe? It's a race. This was ethnic annihilation. A people. Jews. 10 million Jews, Moses. 10 million.
Heard it was only 2 million. But who's counting?
Shagets! And what do you do about it? Do you pick up a bayonet and fight? No, you go exhume some anti-Semitic army schmuck.
Funny. Didn't see you over in Normandy.
There's other ways of fighting. You knew what I was doing. I was getting a degree, a real job.
Ouch. You got me there, Eli. But I know it's gotta goad you that Patrick Walsh was decorated.
Someone like that.
Kaufman wiped his mouth with a monogrammed napkin. J and H. He rested his elbows on the table.
Somebody who beat up Jews for sport. Right in your own backyard. They buried him at Arlington, with honors. Kind of ironical, considering all those mass graves. Graves Patty Walsh probably would have spit on.
Eli was flustered.
I had a motion before the Anti-Defamation League to look into him, but there are more important battles and limited resources.
Kaufman folded his hands behind his head.
Sounds like you guys could use a PI.
Don't push it, Moshe.
He looked at Kaufman with a defeated weariness.
What we need are more lawyers. But I'll make a call in the morning.
Thanks, Elijah.
Kaufman ran a finger under his chin.
And I got one more favor to ask.
Chapter 27.
Yay! Uncle Moshe's staying over!
Eli had retired, probably to pore over Talmud, and the kids were back in gear.
Uncle Moshe! Uncle Moshe! Let's play circus!
Sammy began to climb over Kaufman like he was a jungle gym.
You, little man, need to take a bath.
Judith hoisted the tot over her shoulder. He began to kick his legs.
Not now!
He squealed.
Yes, now. It's late. And you have school tomorrow? I want to listen to radio. No. Green Hornet's on at 7:30. Please, Mommy, please. You listen to radio this afternoon. Chick Gardner. Chick Carter. Chick Carter. Chick Carter, boy detective. I want to listen to a whole grown-up show. Chick Carter's only actually 15 minutes. Green Hornet! He hunts the biggest game of all!
Sammy started buzzing the flight of the bumblebee. Judith smiled shyly at Kaufman.
We never let him listen to radio at night. It winds him up.
She now had the boy across the back of her neck like a young farm animal.
Don't think you can get him wound any tighter than he already is.
Kaufman reached over and tickled Sammy's exposed belly.
How you know about the Green Hornet, Pipsqueak? Fess up.
Stop, Uncle Moshe, stop!
Talk, kid.
He wormed a finger into the boy's collarbone.
Please, Moses.
But Judith was laughing, too.
I'll never get him to bed. Daddy listens to it. Stop tickling!
Oh, does he now?
Kaufman released the boy, and Judith lowered him to the ground.
After your bath,
she said in a whisper.
I'll let your uncle read to you. How's that?
Sammy tried climbing back on Kaufman.
Read me a horror story.
No, something nice.
Judith grabbed him by the scruff of the neck.
For you and your sister.
And marched him towards the bathroom. Rachel poked out her head.
Mommy, the bath almost full. I made it warm, but not too warm.
She ducked back in. Kaufman noticed that the dolly had remained on her fingers. He looked around the home of Kaufman Frere. Certainly an improvement over his pit in Providence. Eli had sequestered most of their parents' belongings, but there was little evidence here. Something he shared with his brother. Buried feelings. The dishes Kaufman had recognized, though. Rosenthal. Pink rosebuds. Gilt edges. And there was a wall of framed photographs along the hallway and over the dining table. Pictures of their parents, or taken by their parents. Kaufman was surprised to see a shot of him and Eli at his brother's bar mitzvah. It was not long after that pose that Kaufman moved out. It was the same photo he had hanging in his office in Providence. As he wandered past the den, he tossed Eli an aside.
Almost time for Green Hornet.
Hummed the tune as he went to the kitchen to wash the rest of the dishes for Judith. Well, it's that time again. This was Kaufman's Holiday, Episode 3. And you can be pretty certain there'll be an Episode 4 somewhere down the road. Once again, a special thanks to Chris Durian for our theme song here, Case Closed. And to Arthur Rosen for all the music in between. Sunday Night Noir is hosted by Radio Free Brooklyn, and they're a swell bunch who could sure use a helping hand. So why don't you give them one? Go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. You can also sponsor a program like this one here. I'd be tickled pink if you did. This is Matt Mittler signing off. But I'll be back. You'll hear me coming. My floor chimes clacking on the cobblestones.